Welcome to the Chag HaSmicha Shir and breakfast this morning, which is in honor of our assistant rabbi, Rabbi Mordechai Shiffman, and which is the Shir will be delivered in a few minutes by Rabbi Chaim Angel. I'd like to start off by thanking and acknowledging our sponsors this morning for the breakfast and this Torah opportunity, Jake and Karen Abelevitz, who are sponsoring in memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avraham, as well as Karen's brother, Yehoshua ben Shimon Dov, Zichronam Levracha. We are very fortunate for the support that Jake and Karen provide us today and throughout the year on multiple occasions in order to enrich our spiritual lives, that our Torah should be deep and appreciated, and the opportunities that, many opportunities that we have would not come our way were it not for the generosity of Jake and Karen Abelevitz. The Torah this morning should inspire us and deepen our appreciation for Megillas Esther, and the learning should be a zechus for the neshamas of the individuals who we've just mentioned. Just a brief statement or idea that I'd like to share with you regarding our honoree this morning, Rabbi Shiffman. Rabbi Shiffman has brought a wonderful, has been a wonderful addition to our shul. He's brought an energy, an initiative. His shiurim are always interesting and intellectually incisive. He is a person that has an attention to detail. He's not just an ideas man. And just as an example, sometimes we see what he does from the pulpit or in the front of the room, but very often Rabbi Shiffman's contributions are in behind the scenes. But Rabbi Shiffman I would like to publicly state my appreciation as the rabbi of the shul and our appreciation as a congregation of the shul to the many benefits that we accrue to us as a result of Rabbi Shiffman's presence in our community. And I am... And I'm confident that his involvement in the shul will continue to deepen, and we will feel his presence in additional ways in the months and years to come. Rabbi Angel is a well-known figure at Yeshiva University and beyond. I guess I have to say a disclaimer. If I say anything nice about Rabbi Angel, it might come from my own personal relationship with him as we go back many years to our own days together at YU. But I think that disclaimer is not necessary because Rabbi Angel's accomplishments and his contributions and the affection of his students and his own congregants over the years really speak for themselves. Rabbi Shiffman pointed out to me that Rabbi Angel's classes, like many classes in YU, you have to sign up for them at the beginning of a semester, and some classes it goes in ranking. So, you know, seniors and juniors get to register for the class before freshmen and sophomores. And apparently, Rabbi Angel's classes always get registered very quickly. And Rabbi Shiffman shared with me that once when he was a sophomore at YU, somebody came, they were having lunch one day, and somebody came running to the table and said, five spots opened up in Rabbi Angel's classes, in Rabbi Angel's class, and people went running to the registrar to go register for his class. Recently, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs was appointed as a visiting professor at Yeshiva University, and the commentator ran an article about it, and he'll be giving a class, and they said that his class is going to fill up very quickly, just like Rabbi Angel's. So it is a real delight this morning for us to have Rabbi Angel in our presence. His topic this morning is Megillat Esther, what they didn't teach us in school, And Rabbi Angel, just a word for the stats, if you're keeping them, is the National Scholar of the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals. He teaches advanced Tanakh courses to undergraduates as well as to the Smicha students at YU, and he lectures widely. He has published over 100 scholarly articles, primarily in Bible, and is the author or editor of 11 books. He previously served for 17 years as rabbi at the Congregation Sheareth Israel in New York, and he lives in New York with his wife and daughters. Rabbi Angel's recent book, A Synagogue Companion, Ideals, Institute for Jewish Ideals, Ideas and Ideals is the publisher, A Synagogue Companion, Insights into the Torah, Haftarah, Shabbos Morning Prayer Services. Rabbi Angel gifted that to us, and I plan on using it perhaps to help me provide some insight in my Shabbos morning drushas. So thank you, Rabbi Angel, for that. Without any further ado, Rabbi Chaim Angel.
Good morning. Thank you, Rabbi Tokayer. Rabbi Tokayer was very kind. We do go back to our yeshiva days. He was my very first dorm counselor. Did a swell job, so our memories very much go back, and it's a pleasure coming to you on your home turf and your community. And, you know, it's not a eulogy situation. I don't want to lavish praise on Mordechai Shipman beyond what, you know, just a very brief comment, which is what I always liked about him as a student is that he was always one of those top flight intellects, his piercing insights, his questions. He kept me on my toes. I love students like that. So that was always a good thing, but that's not what impresses me about excellent students. What impresses me is when they're a mensch. And I think you, in your exposure and getting to know Rabbi Shipman as a rabbi, he's somebody who brings an unbelievable amount of warmth, caring, sincerity, and just all-around genuine man. And that's what I respect in an individual. It's something I like the sharp, hard questions. That's what makes the shiur dynamic so much fun and exciting. But it's really the greatness of a character that is something that shines forth. And you're very, very fortunate to have Rabbi Shipman. Rabbi Shipman, thank you so much for having me out in your honor. It's really my honor to be here with you and to be learning together with your community. Mazal tov to Meira as well, and to the entire family. There are different Sfarim that I think of as hard to teach in any capacity that I do. For example, Zechariah, it's a killer. Those visions, if you've ever tried to read them, the words, the parshanut, Rashi throws his hands up at the beginning. You know you're in trouble when Rashi says, this book is really hard. That's how he starts his commentary. And Ibn Ezra, Rashi's arch critic, gets up there and says, this book is really hard. So at least they're in agreement, but on the other hand, it throws us for some kind of a loop. But educationally speaking, I find that teaching Megillat Esther in so many ways is by far the hardest sefer to teach. Not because the words are hard, not because my students are unfamiliar with it and will remain unfamiliar with it, but because I'm afraid they're a little bit too familiar with it. And whatever they learned when they were in nursery school or kindergarten and art projects, you know, I have twin daughters, they're three. I'm already getting used to this on a personal level. They came home a couple of weeks ago with a picture of Kriyat Yamsuf that they had to color in. The coloring was spectacular, in my opinion. But the picture, of course, had the men with shrimals, and all the men were on all the men were on one side and all the women were on the other side. I actually plan on writing a hostile letter to the publisher once I can figure out who the publisher is. As long as you're making everything up, have two different paths, one from the men and one for the women. And that would be, you know, once truth no longer matters, just go for it and actually subscribe to the vision that you want. I find that those coloring books, you know, for me it's just like a fun thing that I'm smiling at now, but I know at some point I'm going to have to undo some of this damage with my children without undermining their teachers, which is always a very, very tough challenge. And that goes all the more so for Megillat Esther. And it all goes back to good old Pshat and Drash. There's nothing fancy about the shiur. Pshat and Drash, our Parshanut tradition understands very well that what Chazal teach is of utmost importance, but we mustn't dump Midrashei Agadah onto the text and pretend that it is a substitute for the text. And as long as we're able to see what's in the text of Megillat Esther, and what Chazal have to offer, and my oh my, they have great things to offer, then we deepen our understanding. But if we think that the Midrash is in the text, then it's really hard to learn Megillat Esther. And I find that one of the best things I could do when I have four shiurim in a row to do this, I'm not going to do that today, but if I have four shiurim in a row to do something like this, what I go for is the first shiur I announce. Today's shiur is just to undermine everything you've learned since you were three. Not because I want you to lose your faith in Megillat Esther, because I want you to walk away feeling befuddled. Don't worry, next week we'll take care of that. But for this week, we just need to make sure to challenge everything you ever learned. And by the way, you'll see in just a second how easy that is. It's a little scary. And then try to build something up. So today we're going to do that in the under an hour version, trying to put all of those different pieces together, at least in some global sense, of what Megillat Esther may be about. Give you some easy examples of stuff that I've been taught since I was three, and some of you may have had the same thing. Who's Haman's ancestor? Amalek. How do you know? Ha'agagi, right? He's called Ha'agagi five different times in the Megillah. So, and how do you know that that's Amalek? Well, Agag, and who is Agag? We're good. This is a knowledgeable and bustling crowd. I like that. Good. So who's Agag? Melech Amalek. When? Shaul's time. Okay, we are so on track. We are ready for a holiday. I like that. Now, it's true that there was a king named Agag from Amalek in Shaul's time, some 500 years or so before the story. But how do you know that Haman is descended from this guy? The answer is, of course, you don't. Neither do I. We can't know that this is the same person. You should know that Agag was a perfectly normal Persian name. That doesn't mean that it's just saying, oh, by the way, he was from some family named the Agagite family in Persia. I don't know what it means. But I don't know for sure that it means that he's descended from Amalek and that he's descended from this man. There are plenty of Midrashic traditions that say that he is. And look, the Haftarah that we read for Haftarat Zachor liturgically rubs that point home, and that's great. But we're not sure on the factual historical level, is Megillat Esther trying to teach that? Other example. The whole point within this framework, why do you care so much that Haman is from Agag? Because you also care about who Mordechai and Esther are from, right? Who are they from? They're from King Shaul. So this is like a rematch. That's great. It's certainly conceptually excellent no matter how you slice this. How do you know that Mordechai and Esther are from Shaul exactly? Oh, he's from Kish, right? Right. Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish. And Kish was? Well, he's from Sheva Binyamin. We could all agree. Mordechai and Esther are from the same tribe as King Shaul. That's fine. But why would you think that Mordechai and Esther are from King Shaul, descendants of his? What about Kish is so special? Kish is the name of Shaul's father. So in other words, if you take that as pshat, what you're saying is that these three generations back are not three generations, right? We're going back also some 500 years. Ibn Ezra asked the question 800 years ago on this particular point. He says, you know, if Megillat Esther wanted to tell us that Mordechai and Esther were descendants of King Shaul, you know what it probably would have said? You could probably help me here. Ben Yair, Ben Shimi? Yes, thank you. We don't need Kish at all. Kish is, I mean, he was, I'm sure, an excellent, great man. I mean, he was the father of Israel's first king. But if you're going to go back to some famous ancestor, and there's a king in this, you're not going to go back to his dad, you're going to go back to him. It's just as possible, of course, that Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Yair could be Mordechai's father, and Shimi could be Mordechai's grandfather, and Kish might be his great-grandfather. Nothing so revolutionary. We really don't know that Mordechai and Esther are descended from Shaul, and we don't know that Haman is descended from Amalek. They might be, I can't tell you no. I just don't think that there's anything in the Megillah that says one way or the other that will help us. Now conceptually you understand, Haman is evil, Mordechai and Esther are great, so we can still imagine that rematch, and maybe the Megillah wants us to think about this rematch, but it's not at all clear. Another example. This one's a lot harder because this gets to the heart of what's the message of the Megillah. What was the religious state of the Jews at the time of the Megillah? What do we know about their religious state? Not good, okay? Not good. How about really, really, really bad? And tell me some bad things about them. What makes them so bad? Party with Achashverosh, good. And, I mean, not good. It's horrible. But yeah, but anyway, yeah. Huh? Okay, so we have the names, the very names, including our honoree, right? Mordechai is a perfectly pagan name, going back to Marduk. And my father's also Mordechai. It's become a Jewish name thanks to our story, right? But in other words, the patron deity of Babel was Marduk, and Mordechai is simply a something of that. Astarte is at least a reasonable understanding of where the name Esther comes from. They're perfectly good pagan names. But let's go back to the party. So any other things that we know about the religious state of the Jews at the time of the Megillah? Or is it all about the party and they were really horrible? By the way, what was wrong with the party? Kaylee, the wine, okay. If you guys have a Kiddush club, you better talk to somebody about that. But anyway, yeah. What? Mixed eating, okay. It all goes back to the Red Sea. Anyway, yeah. Okay, good. Okay, what else do we know about this party that would be really atrocious if the Jews went there? The Kalim of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, that's pretty terrible. Meaning, are you saying that the, just make sure I'm clear on this, because I was taught this too, that the party is celebrating the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, and Jewish participation in that is not just wine or mixeding or whatever issues there might be, but rather they're celebrating the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore they are foregoing their entire identity and dream. That would be atrocious. Now, you know, of course, that there's nothing in the Megillah about any of that, right? Just to make sure that there was a party. In fact, there were two. But we don't know that the party was there to celebrate the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. All that the party reflects, according to the Pshat, is it's celebrating what? The power and glory of the king. Yes, there was wine. Yes, there might be immodesty. And certainly Achashverosh was hoping for even more immodesty than he ended up getting thanks to Vashti's refusal. But it's not at all clear that the Megillah is talking about the Beit HaMikdash here, there, or anywhere else. What do we know about the Jews in the text of the Megillah? What do we know about them? I'll tell you something. There are very few books in Tanakh, and you should appreciate this heavily, where the Jews look as good as they do in Megillat Esther. They look fabulous. They're so nice. And I'm just going to ham this up for a moment. That's probably the wrong word to use in a shul. But in the meantime, let's just play up what we actually do see about the Jews in the Megillah. Mordechai and Esther send messages. Okay, everybody, we need the entire nation to fast 3 days. And the Jews right away just do that. That's hard. One day is hard. 3 days is really hard. They all just do that. They show tremendous solidarity with their leaders. They listen to their leaders. How many biblical books can you find where that happens? Right? That's pretty nice. They're the ones who actually initiated the holiday at the end. And Mordechai and Esther ratified that holiday. That's pretty good. This is kind of crazy, but Haman, when he comes in to accuse the Jews, and he's getting ready to write a very big fat check to Achashverosh to exterminate the Jews, what's his accusation? That what? They follow their own laws. They don't follow Persian laws. Wow, it sounds like they're anything but assimilated. I don't like Haman very much. I'm sure you don't like him either. But if our enemy has to accuse us of being different because we're keeping our own laws, I actually sort of trust him. So do Chazal in source number one. I hope that you have source sheets. I've been getting mixed reports about whether I should read in Hebrew and then translate, or whether I should read in English and then use Hebrew words when appropriate. Gotten good advice in both directions. So I'll try one way one time, and then maybe we'll shift it over at some point. Source number one. Kol ma sha'aya ma mikat reget Yisrael milamata. Every time Haman accused the Jews of something down here on earth, haya Michael melamed alehem sanigoria milmala. Who's Michael in our tradition? He's our defense angel. He's the one who's coming to bat for us in the heavenly court. Amar lefanav. Michael comes to God. Ribono shel olam. Look what Haman is accusing us of. He's not that we're idolaters, or that we're murderers, or that we're adulterers. Haman is accusing the Jews of being faithful to their tradition. That midrash is spot on in Pshat. Spot on. Not only that, but the party thing that many of us are taught, let's just look at the passage in the Talmud where this comes from. It's actually an amazing thing that's going to happen very quickly. Shalu Talmidav and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. So Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai is giving a shiur and all of his students are there. So the students say, Rebbe, why do the Jews deserve to be destroyed? Mipnei manit chayvu sonehen shel Yisrael shebeoto ador klaya. Why did the Jews deserve destruction at the time of Megillat Esther? Amar lahem,
Imratem, you should tell me. He's an excellent teacher. He's not just rattling off a lecture and making him write down notes as quickly as possible, but rather, he says, okay, what do you think? So the students say, oh, the party. There you go, ta-da, here it is in the Talmud. That's where we all got it from. The students propose that it's because of Jewish participation in the party that they deserve destruction. And of course, the way that we've set it out, that here's the celebration of the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash involving trade food, lots of wine, and immodesty. Okay, that's really bad. And if that's what the Jews are all doing, that's terrible. That's really a very sinful state to be in indeed. But Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, in the very next line, in the very Talmudic passage that we all quote to prove this point, rejects this answer because it is totally wrong. Okay, so Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, okay, students, good try, but you're wrong. He says, Im Kain, Shabishushan Yargu, Shabachol Olam Kulam, Kulo Al Yargu. Wait a minute. There were two parties, right? Who was the first party for? It lasted 180 days. Who was it for? It was for the governors of all the distant countries, or the states, or provinces, whatever you want to call them, right? That means a couple of people per, you know, a couple of delegates per country. Most Jews who lived there did not participate in that at all. And the second party, which was for 7 days, who participated there? All the citizens of Shushan were invited. So Shimon Bar Yochai said, it doesn't make any good theological sense to say that all the Jews of the world deserve annihilation if only the Jews of Shushan participated in a party. So he rejects their answer and it's done. It doesn't get back onto the table. The students say, okay, we're wrong. So you should just realize, quoting this source rejects the answer of the party. So then they say, okay, so you tell us now. Amrulo imorata. Amar lahem ibnei shehishtachavu latzelem, which Rashi understands to mean that 3 generations ago, most of the Jews bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue in Daniel Perek Gimel. And that raises all kinds of interesting and important theological discussions of, okay, so why would 3 generations later deserve this punishment at all? It's the great-grandparents who messed things up, and that's a good discussion for another time. But for our purposes, they ask back, V'chi maso panim yesh badavar, so okay, if they bow to a statue, destroy them. Why were they let off the hook? Amar lahem, hem lo asu ela lifanim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asa imahen ela lifanim. Look, they only bowed because they were at pains of death. They were afraid. So God figured the right punishment is to bring the whole Purim story to scare the daylights out of the Jews, but he was never planning on punishing anybody. This is an amazing, amazing theological discussion. We could spend a whole shiur just on that. We're not going to, at least not today. But you understand, and all I need from this source for today is, this very Talmudic passage that mentions the party as the cause behind the whole thing rejects that answer. I also want to say that I have to thank the sponsors of the breakfast too. I always request water when I speak, but never before have I gotten an entire gallon of water. So I appreciate your generous sponsorship, the Chaim Tovim. Hold on 1 second. All right, so far we don't know exactly where... Oh, very good. Well, we got a lot of work to do in under an hour. So here we go. Ready? So far we don't know exactly the biological descent of Haman, Mordechai, or Esther. And the bigger problem is, it's not a problem, it's actually good. The Jews seem fantastic. And yet here everybody's trying to find some sin because they're dealing with the bigger problem of why did they deserve it? Exactly the context of the Talmudic passage that I just quoted to you. But the answer of the Gemara is we just don't know. We don't understand God's role in the story because, of course, God is completely behind the scenes, which brings us to the important statistics. Not only did the Jews seem good, but surprisingly, there's nothing ritually serious about anything that happens in the Megillah. There's nothing distinctly Jewish other than the word HaYehudi. There's nothing about Torah. There's nothing about any particular mitzvah observance of the Jews. There's not anything about any particular observance of Mordechai and Esther, despite their pagan names. That doesn't mean that they are assimilated. Many Jews throughout the ages have had names deriving from non-Jewish culture, and they're perfectly excellent and pious Jews. All I can tell you is, we know nothing about their Jewish religious state at all. I can just tell you that the Jews look great, but I don't know whether they were keeping Shabbat properly, what their idolatry situation was. It's just not relevant to Megillat Esther at all. That brings us to one even more curious point. You'd all agree with me right away because this is just the way the story goes. The whole reason the Purim story happened is because Mordechai refused to bow to Haman. That set him off, and it turns out that he's a crazy megalomaniac who decides, why just kill him? Let's go for his entire nation. And that's the story, right? All right, so why didn't Mordechai bow?
He had the ring.
He had... Help me out here. Why didn't...
He was a Jew.
He was a Jew, but what's wrong with a Jew bowing to Haman? I'm not advocating this. I just want to know. What,
he has an idol around his neck.
Okay. Anything else? He has an idol around his neck. By the way, even Ezra, he's supposed to be the great Pashtan, and he is the great Pashtan. He's so bothered by this question, he says, yeah, there must have been an idol. He quotes the very Midrash, yeah?
He loves that Midrash for a very simple reason. All things in terms of worship.
Indeed. You're absolutely right, Rav Nachman, but simultaneously, there's nothing in our text, I'm sure you'd all agree with this just as much, that the Midrash that casts Haman as this pagan Esh HaTorah outreach type guy who derives great satisfaction in wearing an idol and having people bow to him, and while you think you're just bowing out of deference to the king's high attendant, in fact you are worshiping his idol, and he feels really good about that, right? Okay, there's nothing in the text at all, not only about Haman wearing an idol, he was a pagan, don't get me wrong, all the Persians were pagans, but paganism plays a grand total of zero role in our story altogether. Not just there, but anywhere. It was a pagan empire. But there's nothing about idols or idolatry. Here's the best pagan reference. You're ready for this? You'll love it. The New Year's festival is when Haman drew his lots, and that was a pagan festival. Okay, but you don't care. Neither do I. That has no relevance. As far as we're concerned, it could have been just as well if it were not the New Year holiday and he just drew some dates out of a hat. We wouldn't care, because what matters to our plot is, okay, Yud Gimel Adar is now important to us, but that became the day of Haman's decree. But there's nothing about paganism at all in our story. Why in the world would you think that Haman is wearing an idol? Well, why would you think that? Because why else would he risk his life? Right? It doesn't make any sense otherwise. It's crazy to imagine that he's just doing this to defy the king and his officers. And that's exactly how the Midrash that you are all quoting frames this in source number 3. Well, source number 3 is just the text, okay? So let's read the text. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech kor'im u'mishtachavim le-haman d'chein tzivad lo ha-melech. Because the king had ordered that everybody should bow to the king. U'mordechai lo yikrav lo yishtachavev. But Mordechai refused to bow. V'yamru avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech le-mordechai madu ata over mitzvat ha-melech. Why are you defying the king? That's all the text says. That Mordechai is defying the king. So he doesn't answer them. It's something about his Jewishness, but I really don't know what. All I know is that he's defying the king, because he is, and he's defying the king's, vice president, so to speak, but we have no clue why he is doing that. So the Midrash raises this problem. The Midrash in source number 4 that all of you were quoting, all that it says in the text is that he's defying the king's decree, but is he such a troublemaker that he would just do that? That's crazy. It can't be. Therefore, ta-da. Elak shetzivach hashverosh yishtachavot lehaman chakak avodat kochavim alibov nikaven kedesh yishtachavu lavodat kochavim. Exactly what you were saying, bam, here it is in the Midrash. Great. But you understand that this Midrash is coming to play in because the text isn't giving us any answers. In fact, shockingly, because the whole story turns on this. Had Mordechai bowed, okay, Haman might really be a bad guy and something else might have set him off another day. Okay. But our story would not be the same had Mordechai either bowed or taken a coffee break at that time or just come to work late every day. Right? All he had to do was not be there and stand out. His decision to defy Haman so publicly in the king's courtyard, all it says in the text is that he's defying the king's decree, but we don't understand why that would matter. Oh, must be idolatry. That we can sink our teeth into. Mordechai was the representative Jew who was willing to give his life, Yehareg ve'al ya'avor. He was willing to give his life over this. Okay. I hope you're convinced by now that we don't know anything. This is crazy. This is the most familiar story ever. Right? It's really right on up there with Noah and the ark, my daughter's being three, so that means we're still at the point where it's all about the giraffes and the lions on the boat, and at some point we'll learn that everybody died. Right? In other words, that's the way these things go. And, there are certain stories, you teach it in layers, but at least you got the first layer right. Here we are in Megillat Esther, and we have no clue why Mordechai refuses to bow from the text.
We're not sure if the ancestry of these characters matters in the least, and all I can tell you is that the Jews look really good, but I'm not sure if they're religiously good or not. I don't know anything. So I'm really baffled as to, okay, so then what's the point of the Megillah? What is it coming to teach? So I'll tell you, one of my great educationally exciting and traumatic moments, they often come together, was back in 1997. I remember it well. It was the first time I was going to teach Megillah to Esther up at Yeshiva University. And I was all psyched up. I had some great stuff, and I had some great notes, and I was all pumped up to give some of the best of all I had learned from my childhood through my very young adulthood. And I had it all worked out, and I was so excited, and I had great sources, including many of the ones you and I are looking at today. But, you know, the way that I am, I'm a pest in this regard to myself. I'm always constantly looking for new articles and new perushim because learning is a growing process. You don't just settle for what you got in your notebook or on your computer. You're always looking for more to see. Did I miss something? Is there another angle? And I read one article during the semester. I was in Megillat Rut, and Esther is here. And so, okay, so I'm looking at some more Esther articles that I had found. And it was written by somebody named Rabbi David Henschke, who's more of a Mishnah man, actually. But he wrote one article on Megillat Esther in the journal called Megadim around 1995. It had just come out fairly recently to this story. And I read it. It was 12 pages long. And I thought about it for a few minutes, and I read it again. And I went to my computer, and I deleted all of the shiurim that I was about to give. Because he was right, and I was wrong. And I realized that everything that I thought, and I was about to give shiurim on, including some of the things that I just very briefly challenged, well, I had all kinds of great stuff to say about all of that. But I realized it was based on faulty assumptions that are not at all in the text, and are not even based on good readings of the Midrashim I thought I was going to bring. So you don't want to give shiurim like that, even if it's 2 weeks away. So you panic a little bit, and you try to scramble, and you get in there. You tell the students what you need to tell them. I just explained it. Okay, I thought I was going to teach you A, but that's all wrong. And I'm trying to figure out B, but it might take me a year or two. So by the next time around, I'll be in much better shape. So by now, we're thank God, you know, it's been a bunch of years since then, so we're past the next time around. And Rav Henschke certainly has decisively influenced my understanding of the Megillah. It's not the only thing that has decisively influenced me, but it changed the whole world. Because he asked a question that nobody had asked me before, or at least if they did, I wasn't paying enough attention. And as soon as he asked the question, all of a sudden it just all came together. It was so cool. Watch this. You're going to buy it too. Watch. So what's the point of the party in chapter 1? It's a very lavish description of a party about the fabrics they had and the drinking and the this and that and who came and all of that. Who cares? Good for him. He was a wealthy king. He threw parties. All wealthy kings throw parties. Go to the mansions in Newport, Rhode Island. I'm sure you may have done that. I went there once. I'm such a nice guy and I'm such a not troublemaker, but it roiled me that some of these guys have 76 sets of silverware and they don't even have to worry about dairy or corn. Like, what do you need all that stuff for? So I would ask on all these tours, were these people at least involved in philanthropy? And they didn't like that question too much. But in the meantime, so I decided I'd keep my mouth closed and just pretend that this was a good thing, that they had all this silver, not even Pesach. I didn't get it. But in the meantime, okay, so fine. So Achashverosh threw a very lavish party. Good for him. I'm sure there are plenty. That's not Tanakh-worthy. That happens all the time. That's what ancient kings do. They have a ton of money and they appease their diplomats. It's a great way to do it. Why is that there? Why do we care from a plot point of view? What does the party help us? So help me out here. It makes a difference. We do care that there was this party because something happened there. Very good. Very good. The only thing that matters from a plot point of view is not the lavishness of the party, but that Vashti is no longer queen by the end of the Perek. And it doesn't say that she got killed, by the way, and I learned that hard lesson the first time I ever taught Megillat Esther, where I said she got killed, and somebody in the audience said, where does it say that? And I said, right here, and I looked down, and I'm like, oh, wow, it's not there. Okay, it's not here. That's how I learned. And so it's actually not in the text that she was killed. We know that she's not queen anymore, so it could be she's dead. It could be that since the king doesn't reverse decrees, she could have been banished. I'm fine imagining that she got killed too. Regardless, that made a job opening for Esther. That's why the whole chapter matters. But you don't need the whole chapter for that. You could just say, once upon a time there was a king, and he needed a wife, so he had a beauty contest. We could have gone right to chapter 2, and none of us would have missed the fabric of the palace. Who cares, right? Let me ask you a bigger problem. You know, Chapter 9, the Jews win the war. They celebrate. We have two different holidays, regular Purim and Purim Shushan for the walled city people. They have all the laws that now you and I observe. It's all great. And they lived happily ever after. I'm waiting for the end after chapter 9. They made the holiday, we are done, we won. And what happens instead? The most anticlimactic chapter in all of Tanakh. What happens over there? The king made attacks. Okay, that's what ancient kings do. That's what contemporary governments do. You tax your people. Okay. What happened to the happily ever after thing? What do you need this tax and power and glory of Ahasuerus for? It's not only irrelevant, it's less relevant than the party, but really, who cares? Like, the story's done. We won. We're celebrating this holiday because we won the war. We're thankful to God because we're not dead. So Wahoo News chapter 10. And the answer is, as soon as Rakhanchka said it, I'm like, yeah, maybe because we're missing the point. The story is not about the Jews against Haman at all. That's a trivial side point to what the story is really about. It's an important part of it, but it's not about Haman versus Mordechai and Esther. And it's not about the Jew haters and the Jews. It's all about Ahasuerus. It's all about him. Nobody else, right with this one, really matters that much. Ahasuerus thoroughly dominates the narrative so crazily that we all of a sudden seem to care about the wealth of his palace and the parties, and we care about him taxing the people, because that's what the Megillah wants us to focus on. From the Department of Statistics pertaining to the kings, HaMelech or Melech or Malchut, all these different words in our Megillah appears about 200 times. That's a lot, right? There's only 167 psukim. So when you just read the Megillah, come prepared. You're going to go crazy when you hear this. You know, when Esther is risking her life, she's fasted for 3 days, she's about to go into the throne room, all of that. You know the story. All right, I'm just going to read with a couple of italics and you'll get my point. Beginning of chapter 5, this is, you can, and every pasuk really in the whole Megillah sounds like this. Vayhi bayom ha-shlishi, va-tilbash Esther malchut, va-tamod b'chatzer bet ha-melech ha-pnimi, nochach bet ha-melech, v'ha-melech yoshev al-kisei malchuto b'vet ha-malchut. That's just pasuk aleph. And I got six. I don't have enough fingers. Okay, because I need these guys for this one. All right? It goes on like that. The whole Megillah sounds like this. So Ahasuerus sure gets a lot of attention. And who gets no attention at all and is not mentioned any times at all? Hashem's name is zero times. Why not? Huh? Esther Panim is certainly part of this, yeah? And it's all about HaMelech. In fact, you can make the case very quickly that one of the scariest parts of our Megillah is that Ahasuerus, his role in our Megillah is what God's role always is in any other biblical book. And that's really scary. Because I don't like this guy, and I'm sure you don't like this guy very much either. And even if you liked him, you still don't want anybody to replace God. It gets even worse when you think about the role of his palace. Let me just tell you the story of the party, and it's going to sound just a little bit different, but you'll get it right away. Okay, and the story opens up, and the king in his glorious palace is sitting there. And all the nations of the world come to celebrate the glory of Ahasuerus and his palace. Okay, but what do I wish that I was describing instead? And what do all the Nevi'im wish that I was describing instead? I should have been describing the Beit HaMikdash. That's the way Yeshayahu wishes for every... The hub should be Yerushalayim. The hub should be a Beit HaMikdash, everybody serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Jews being good Jews, non-Jews being good non-Jews. That's what Mashiach is. The party is very significant. He's not celebrating the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. He doesn't care about the Beit HaMikdash, okay? But we do, and when we read this story, we should be heartbroken. It's like, wow, the glory of the world, Melo Kol Ha'aretz Kevodo. We say it all the time in the Kedusha, but it's Melo Kol Ha'aretz Kevodo, it's Kevod Ahasuerus. If you want to hear how crazy this is in Pshat in the Megillah, I'll describe you a scenario. The scenario is, all the Jews are fasting. And their leader is fasting too. And the leader is about to go into a very awesome room to plead on behalf of the Jewish people for their lives at pains of death. Meaning the leader going into that room, if you do anything wrong by entering, bad things could happen to that leader. Okay, what am I describing? I'm describing Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, all the Jews are fasting, the Kohen Gadol is fasting too. The Kohen Gadol is about to go into the Kodesh Kodashim, or God's throne room, at pains of death, to plead on behalf of the Jewish people. It's a very severely important moment. What am I also describing?
I'm describing Esther. How crazy is that? The king's throne room has replaced the Kodesh Kodashim. It's crazy how the Megillah has rigged everything so that Ahasuerus is replacing God. His palace is not just a lavish, wealthy place. You're missing the point. It's replacing the Beit HaMikdash. This is horrible. This is really, really, really horrible. All those midrashim about Ahasuerus being unbelievably compulsive against the Beit HaMikdash, again, the midrashim are not about what's going on in Ahasuerus' mind. He doesn't care about us or our Beit HaMikdash at all. We're a tiny dot on the Persian map. But we care everything about the Beit HaMikdash. And if Ahasuerus, his pagan king, his palace has replaced the Beit HaMikdash, and his throne room has replaced the Kodesh Kodashim, and he is eclipsing God, then you and I have a problem. And that's what the Megillah is about. And the Megillah is about one thing more about Ahasuerus. Oh, by the way, how much do the other characters matter? Zero. Esther, she's our hero, right? And we call it Megillah Esther. That's great, and we salute her heroism. I love it. And when the moment of truth comes, and Mordecai says, okay, this is it. You're going to go in there. It's finally why you became queen. And what does she say? Yeah, my husband might kill me. Sorry. What? Come on. Like, you and I are nodding as well as Mordecai. We're all nodding. This is it. This is a biblical coincidence of the first order. This happens all the time. And we know that this is what's supposed to happen. Esther doesn't feel that way at all. Esther feels, oh, he's the power in the house, which he is. How about Mordecai? Mordecai, after, you know, we all love that story. I love it too. It's terrific. When Haman has to parade Mordecai around, and we're like, yeah! And then that thing about where the daughter dumps the garbage on Haman, I love it. It's fantastic. Mordecai, while he's being paraded around on the king's horse and honored by the king, what's going to happen to him tomorrow? Not literally tomorrow from the point of view of the story. What's going to happen soon to him and his family and his people? They're still slated for destruction, folks. So in other words, it's the most bizarre, capricious thing. This king is terrible. He's honoring Mordecai, but it doesn't really matter at all. Because after all, he is still slated to decree. Here's the craziest part of the whole thing. You think Haman matters? Haman is hanged, okay? He's dead in Perek Zion. And what's the Jewish reaction to that? He's dead. Where's the holiday? What do the Jews react? Well, how do they react? Huh? They don't react at all. They zero. The only emotional mood swing that happens as a result of Haman's death is the king feels better. Oh, how nice. Right? Why aren't the Jews celebrating on the streets? Because Haman doesn't matter. The king matters. It's the ring. Right? They're subjected to the same exact death decree with or without Haman there. Haman doesn't matter. We don't like him. I'm glad he's dead. Don't get me wrong. He and his allies are horrible people. But the Jews don't celebrate. They don't have that simcha v'sasam v'ikar until Mordecai has the king's ring. Oh, now we can celebrate. It has nothing to do with Haman. It has to do with whether we are in the king's favor. It's all about the king, and it's nothing about these other characters who are just playing on Ahasuerus' stage. So that's what's going on in the Megillah. Once you have that, then you realize that the Megillah is doing another thing also. It reminds us of what you and I always have known about Ahasuerus. He's a clown. A bumbling, amoral clown. He makes major decisions when he is drunk. He is under everybody's influence to make very important decisions and pretty much never takes responsibility for anything. Great example of this, and again, Chazal has always had their fingers exactly on the pulse. When Esther finally, at the second party, gets ready to turn in Haman. So we're all cheering her on. This is it. This is the moment we've been waiting for. And she says, you know, somebody wants to destroy us. And Ahasuerus goes, Muzeh v'ezeh, who is this terrible scoundrel who wants to do this? And Esther responds, Haman. Right? Right. Of course, no? That's what she says. Well, Chazal don't buy that. And they say in source number 9, Batomer Esther, Ish Sar Ve'oyev, an enemy wants to destroy us. Haman Arahazeh, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Melamed Shaita Mechava Klape Ahasuerush. She started pointing to the king. And an angel, thank God for angels, right? An angel shows up. An angel got there just in the nick of time and moved her hand away and pointed it to Haman. All right, so this is great stuff for kids, but it's also great stuff for adults. What are Chazal saying? You don't have to be so creative here. Who's the real culprit in our Megillah? Haman is the front. Chazal are just saying that, right? In other words, the whole point is she wanted to point to the king, but that angel realized very well that if she actually said, actually it's you, dear, her consequence would have been what happened to Haman. She would have gotten hanged too. She knows that. And Chazal knows that. You can't criticize the king. The king has zero sense of humor or ability to accept self-criticism. We all know that. He knows that too. And Esther certainly knows that. But Chazal said, don't be fooled by the Haman thing. Yes, he's evil. He's a real Amalek-type character. He's really, really, really bad. I'm not trying to downplay his evil. He is truly evil. But had Ahasuerus not given him a ring for a bribe, that never would have happened. If Ahasuerus had been even moderately moral, moderately, he doesn't have to be a superstar here, moderately moral, Haman comes and says, I'm going to give you 10,000 kikar of kesef, which is a true ton of money. Holy cow, it's a lot of cash. But if Ahasuerus would have said, we don't just commit genocide in my country. In fact, you're deposed from your position. That's all he would have to do. And we'd say, good for you, Ahasuerus. Go back to your party now. It's fine. Enjoy, celebrate, drink with your politicians. That's not what's bothersome in the story. What's sickening is that he just accepts it and moves right ahead. And had he not, had he had any moral backbone at all, the story never would have taken place. And that's what the whole point of this Gemara is. So the Megillah is showing how Ahasuerus is eclipsing God. His palace is eclipsing the Beit HaMikdash, but he's amoral. He's a real problem. And as long as there's an Ahasuerus running the show, Haman's can rise. Haman's could fall, but Haman's could rise. Chazal point out what should be obvious to everybody, but just in case it's not. You might have thought that Ahasuerus had the biggest personality transformation of any character in our Megillah. At the beginning he was against the Jews, and at the end he was for the Jews. Right? He got rid of Haman, he gave Mordechai the ring. Esther is looking very good. You might have thought that. Chazal say, you've got to be kidding me. Hu Ahasuerus, source number 10, Hu Barishal Mitchilato V'ad Sofo. He's a bad man. Ahasuerus cares about one guy and one guy only, and that is Ahasuerus. Whatever works for his interests, that's what he's going to do. So at the beginning of the Megillah, oh, I get 10,000 kikar kesef, great. Wipe him out, here's the ring, don't bother me. Oh, my wife is worried? I don't want her to be worried. Okay, let's hang this guy and give Mordechai the ring, whatever it takes, as long as I don't have to admit that I was wrong and withdraw a decree, all is well, there could be a war. The Megillah is making a parody, a satire of Ahasuerus. He's an amoral guy, and amoral people are extremely, extremely dangerous. So why did Mordechai not bow? Well, because Mordechai understood that he was fighting on two fronts. If he knew how evil Haman is, well then, you understand that just like in a Nazi rally, if somebody got up and protested, even at pains of death, we would salute the unbelievable integrity and moral heroism of such an individual, right? It's incredible. Somebody would stand up against this pure evil. If Mordechai knows, this is an if, that Haman is as bad as we quickly learn that he is, well then we understand Mordechai might do it for that reason. And that's what Rav Yaakov Maidan suggests in an article that he wrote about this question. But there's another dimension that you can't miss anymore. Mordechai is against the king. And that's exactly what the text says. Why are you defying the king's decree? That's all it says. Well, I'm defying the king's decree because we have to fight against the evil Amalek immorality, evil of Haman. We also have to fight against the amoral world of Ahasuerus. Already at that point in the narrative, Mordechai saved Ahasuerus' life and his reward was nothing. It got written in a book which paid off later, but nothing. And then Haman rises to the top. Why? I don't know, but because the king wants it. At that point already, Mordechai realizes this guy's no good. He's promoting Haman. He's not even rewarding somebody who saved his life. This could be very dangerous, and he wasn't disappointed. It was incredibly, incredibly dangerous. Chazal captured this double reading of the Megillah in source... Oh, it's not a source? How could that be? Yeah, source number 11. It's a source. Mordechai yadad asher nasa. After the dirty deal between Haman and Ahasuerus, Mayamar, what did Mordechai say when he was crying in the streets that this terrible thing has happened? Rav Amar, Gavah Haman me'Ahasuerus. Oh no, the evil Amalek figure Haman has defeated neutral, bumbling Ahasuerus. That's how Rav understands the story. Rav is interpreting Megillat Esther on the surface. Namely, Haman is the bad guy, and Mordechai and Esther are out to get him. You know, that's the conflict in our story. That's certainly part of Megillat Esther. So that's one reading of the story. That's Rav's reading. As Rashi says, Achashverosh never planned on exterminating the Jews. So the fact that Haman now got permission means that his agenda has defeated Achashverosh's neutral agenda. Ushmuel Amar, Gavar Malka Ila'ami Malka Tata'a. The upper king has defeated the lower king. Who is the upper king?
God.
Has defeated the lower king is? So what's bad about that? That's good. God defeated Achashverosh. We want that. What's so bad? Why is Mordechai crying that God has defeated Achashverosh? Because it means the opposite. As Rashi says, Chazal don't want to say, I always feel embarrassed translating Talmudic euphemisms, because that means I have to say exactly what Chazal tried so hard to avoid. Right? In other words, Chazal are saying, Achashverosh has defeated God. That's what Rashi says right over here. Right? Kinui hu lehipuch v'lashon nechiyah. Rashi says it's actually a euphemism for the reverse. Mordechai realized Achashverosh is defeating God. He's eclipsing God from the picture. So Shmuel is hitting on the deeper global meaning of Megillat Esther. They're both true. Rav is saying that the conflict is between Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews versus Haman and his allies. That's one part of the story. That's the surface part. But the global part of the Megillah is that it's about God versus Achashverosh. Mordechai has to take on both fights. And that's why he defied Haman. He was defying Haman, but he was also defying Achashverosh. He understood very well somebody around here needs to stand tall, not only to Amalek-type evil, but to the amoral, self-serving government of Achashverosh. Because as long as there is an amoral, self-serving government, even if they're not killing us, but if it's economically in their interest, they might adopt policies that are dangerous. They might allow the Hamans of the world to grow and to succeed and to get the ring. And that's what Megillat Esther is teaching. It's not just a one-time story. That story happened once. The Chazal are pointing out, this is the way of the world. As long as Achashverosh is in charge, very dangerous things can happen. So Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews are the role models of an alternative lifestyle. It doesn't have to be like this. The world doesn't have to be run by Achashverosh. It should be run by God as king, the Beit HaMikdash, all the world, all the nations of the world flooding to Yerushalayim. Ki mitzion tetzei Torah dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. No greater role models for us than the Jews in our Megillah. They live apart, different from the king's laws. They stand tall about their religion. Mordechai, of course, is the extreme version of that. Standing up, defying Haman and defying Achashverosh, because he says you need to have a moral backbone. And Esther, of course, comes through also. All the Jews in the Megillah reflect a broader worldview of something that is right, that we want the whole world to espouse. Certainly all Jews, they're the role models to us as Jewish people. But it's also a role model for just what morality in the world should be. The world can't be governed by an Achashverosh, because then you'll always have another Haman. And that brings us to that terribly anticlimactic story about the king's tax in chapter 10. Why don't we read Hallel on Purim? It's a nice holiday. It's good. We celebrate other holidays with Hallel. It's a pretty basic feature of it, actually. Oh, okay, some good answers here, but okay, so yeah, keep going.
We'll go.
Didn't happen in Eretz Yisrael. Anything else? Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment. Good. Megillah itself counts. Okay, so yeah, the Megillah itself counts as Hallel. So you're quoting the three answers that are in the Talmud. Very good. It's on Megillah, Daf Yud Dalet Amud Aleph. The first answer there is the Chutz La'aretz one. This is a miracle that happened in Chutz La'aretz. The Talmud already raises the pretty obvious question. So are Pesach and Shavuot and Sukkot. As in, like, most of our holidays happen in Chutz La'aretz. Chanukah is the exception. And nowadays, Yom HaAtzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim. But other than that, most holidays that you and I observe, certainly the biblical ones, are Chutz La'aretz holidays, and yet we seem to be able to say Hallel. So answer number one, founders, and again, the Talmud already raises this. I'm not asking a question that they didn't think of or talk about. Second one is that the Megillah counts as Hallel, which is nice, except you'd quickly agree. Megillah is the narrative, and it would be very easy. Yes, it takes another 5 minutes until you get to yet another Hamantash and breakfast, but you can read the Hallel too. Right? You don't even need to sing as much if you're really anxious. It's not such a big deal to recite six psalms that we recite for all other holidays, including rabbinic ones. And that leaves us with the third answer, which is a conceptual answer that has halakhic bearings, and Rav Nachman just said it a moment ago also. Source number 15. Rav Amar is answering this question of why we don't say Hallel. Bishla mahatam. It is fine that on Pesach we should recite Hallel, because it says in the Hallel, the first pasuk, Hallelu avdei Hashem thum, velo avdei paro. The pasuk just says, Hallelu avdei Hashem. Okay, everybody, servants of God, Praise God. So the whole point is, it's Hallel Mitzrayim. And the idea is that we're no longer slaves of Paro, and now we are slaves or servants of God, so it's appropriate to recite Hallel. That's the point of the Hallel according to Rava. But then he says, Elahacha, in the Purim story, Hallelu Avdei Hashem v'lo Avdei Achashverosh. Can we really say, praise God, O servants of God, who are not servants of Achashverosh? But wait a minute, Akati Avdei Achashverosh Anan. We're still servants of Achashverosh. That's why you need a chapter 10 to kill it for us. But chapter 10 in the Megillah, that tiny little three-verse chapter, one little parak about the king and his taxes and his glory, remind us that the Jews are actually, ride with this one, no better off at the end of the story than they were at the beginning of the story. What we thank God for on Purim is that we're not worse off. Right? In other words, we could have been made dead. Had Haman gotten his way, we would have been killed. Okay, we're not. That's what Purim celebrates. Thank God we're not dead. So on the surface level of the Megillah, we won. Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews defeated Haman and his allies. And that's why we have a holiday. But God did not defeat Achashverosh. Achashverosh emerges the champion of this story. And so our holiday is crippled. Instead of all the nations of the world after this story flocking to Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, they're going to flock back to Achashverosh next year. And if somebody else shows up with a big enough bribe, who knows what Achashverosh will do? And once he dies, what will his successor do? The Jews are no safer or better off in any way. And God's glory is no better manifest. At the end of the Megillah, it's very depressing, but that's the truth. And that's what Rava says. That's why we can't say Hallel, because we're still Achashverosh's servants. And he says it in the present tense, which just adds a poignancy to it. It's not just about that one guy named Achashverosh 2,500 years ago. Achashverosh, like everybody else in the story, can be read typologically. The idea is that any self-serving, amoral government, even if they talk in terms of laws and they seem to be so civilized and this was the pinnacle of the civilized world, if they don't have a moral backbone, very dangerous things can happen. New Hamans could always arise. And look, we say that at our Pesach Seder, right? Every generation somebody comes to destroy us, and we need God to come again to help us. What Megillat Esther teaches is that the reason why those enemies keep coming is because there's a lot of Achashveroshes out there. There are a lot of people governing the world who are not Amalek. They're not trying to kill us. They're not trying to destroy morality. But by being amoral and self-serving, they allow the truly immoral people to rise, to succeed, and to get a lot further in the game than we wish that they would. And that's something that's a very alarming message of Megillat Esther. So I don't want to end on such a down note. But that's what Megillat Esther and that's what Purim really are all about. Purim celebrates. We thank God for that he defeated that one Haman, that we're still alive. And at the same time, we feel very crippled about it. The good news is that lurking behind the scenes every step of the way is God's Esther Panim. That's the whole point. That's what gives us religious inspiration from this story. That God is always right behind the scene, waiting to be manifest in Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. But we have to be like Mordechai and Esther and the Jewish people at the time of the Megillah to stand tall and strong and protest not only the Amaleks of the world, but also the Achashveroshes of the world, to teach everybody how important the moral vision of the Torah is, not just for Jews, that would also be a good thing, but not just for Jews, but also for the entire world. And God willing, when we celebrate Purim one day, it will be its full glory. We'll be able to say we defeated Haman, but we also defeated Achashverosh, that the morality of the Torah has finally been adopted by the world, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. And on that happy note, I thank you all for having me. Oh, by all means. Okay, good. I'll leave it to you to say. Sure. We have time for a few questions and answers. Yes.
Yes. And that always bothered me that considering what Mordechai did, you know, for his fellow Jews, why would it say al rov echav?
Right, but through the rov echav, you're asking the classic question that the idea is that the last pasuk at least celebrates Mordechai's reception among the Jewish people, v'ratzui l'rov echav. You could translate, our Rishonim debate whether that what that means. Some say it just means he was beloved by the plurality of the Jews, in which case your question is not a question. Right? In other words, if it means plurality, it means by everybody, by his many brethren. So that's one way that some Rishonim understand it. The other way is the way you're reading it, which is the Talmudic way, that most Jews liked Mordechai afterwards, but not all of them. So within that approach, the Talmud itself says that some who learned all day criticized Mordechai, as great of a man as he was, and even though he helped save the Jews, he was involved in politics too much. He should go back and learn Gemara. So the Talmud has that answer over there. One opinion of Rav Yosef Kara in the 12th century, a student of Rashi, he suggests that actually some Jews never forgave Mordechai for not bowing in the first place. He's the one who got the Jews into trouble. So he suggests that some Jews never forgave that, even though they understand that Mordechai did some terrific things afterwards. But again, it might not even mean that. It might mean that all the Jews loved him. Yes?
You said, my question was
I can't hear, I'm sorry.
A lot of times we used to think of Ahasuerus as a stupid puppet. And what you're saying is maybe he wasn't a stupid. He was really the mastermind of the whole thing. So in that respect, we always say that Hashem is hidden, but we always, whenever we say the word Melech, we think it was a lot of times we're taught to think of the one above, not Ahasuerus. With your interpretation, do you still think that every time we said Melech, we're talking about the one above, or really talking about the people on Ahasuerus?
See, if I had even more time, I would have said, let's look at source number 8, because that's the Midrash that you're quoting right now. So I use it in this shiur exactly for the point. In Pshat, HaMelech doesn't mean God. It means King Ahasuerus. Anybody would agree with that. This Midrash is, I think, making exactly the point of the whole shiur, that God and Ahasuerus are rivals in the Megillah. I think that that Midrash is spot on. But if you take it as Pshat, if you think that God was insomniac, you know, then I think you're misreading the Megillah. Yeah?
There are commentaries that follow your reading of this book today. It's very different from what we heard as children, obviously, and take from it that Jews should have a greater seriousness about engaging with the larger world political process and not just be insular, because in a way, the very absence of the word God in the entire Megillah seems to say if there's going to be a presence of God here, you people are going to have to implement it and express it, because it's not expressly stated here on the surface. You're going to have to be the presence of God's will or values in this situation. It's not obvious.
Right, so two questions were there, right? One is, where are the precedents? The answer is, as I mentioned, this is all straight out of Midrash. The Shiur has no non-Midrashic antecedents. It's a matter of what you do with those Midrashim. In other words, if you take them literally and then impose them onto the text, then I think you fail. But if you just see what Chazal are saying, that Ahasuerus is the real culprit, then Rav Henschka's article, I mean, again, I'm indebted to him, but Rav Henschka's article just showing how all of this works in Pshat, I think, is his contribution. I'm not aware of somebody before him who said it so well. So I give him a lot of credit for that, but it's not really any new idea. It's all in the very Gemarot that everybody quotes, just using them in that sense. In terms of what we Jews should do, I mean, I ask that on a much more global question, in terms of what would the Nevi'im want of us? If all the non-Jews have to be good B'nai Noach, should we open up outreach centers around the world encouraging B'nai Noachhood? So I don't know the answer to that question in terms of how to invest our time and financial resources. That's, I think, a personal decision for a lot of us. I can tell you that most Nevi'im, their emphasis is always try to perfect Jewish society, and then we would be a model to the nations, rather than going out there. Yeshayahu never took a trip to Assyria to try to makariv them, that we know about. He was interested in Jews being good Jews and believed with his whole heart and soul and nevuah that would impact on the world. So that's less than being insular. We still have to have a very clear picture of the world. The political question that you asked is a much broader question. I think good people need to be involved in the political situation because they can make a difference, same as journalism. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Angel, for joining us. Two concluding comments. Number one is that for those of you who are here who are not members of Kingsway and enjoyed hearing Rabbi Angel and perhaps other services and shiurim and tefillah that Kingsway has to offer, we invite you to become members of Kingsway. Also coming up in a couple of Shabbosim, which is Shabbos March 7th and 8th, Parshas Vayikra. It's going to be a YU Shabbos here with Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberg. Shabbos dedicated to the inspirational tefillah and singing. There will be a Friday night oneg as well as a dinner Friday night. Please reserve with the office. And there are flyers on the table. Also, that Motze Shabbos, there's going to be a Malava Malka in honor of the Chever Kadisha, which the entire community is invited to. And then a week later, we have our Purim Carnival for the children and grandchildren of anybody who would like to participate. Oh,
I'm sorry. That's Sunday. So that's a big weekend. So we have Rabbi Weinberg for Shabbos, Motzei Shabbos, the Malava Malka, Chevra Kadisha Malava Malka, Sunday, the annual Purim Carnival. Thank you very much, Rabbi Angel.
Thank you. Thank you.